That was a little clip from juror number two. I don't know if you saw it. It was pretty good. Pretty good. Talk a little bit about jury dynamics, and that's what we're going to be talking about coming up here. As I said before, it's not news that Michael Madigan was convicted by a jury after over 50 hours of deliberation over 11 days. It was a mixed verdict, very complicated. There were some convictions. There were some acquittals, and there were a hung jury on some of the deadlocked counts. And I want to analyze this verdict and what it means in a bigger picture and what we can glean from what the jurors said. With us to talk about this issue is a friend of the show, David Zahner. He's the founder of Zahner Trial Consulting, based here in Chicago. He and his wife, Laura, have helped lawyers in jury selection, mock trials, witness preparation for over a thousand cases in almost every state in the country. Dave, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Doing great. Thanks for having me, Karen.
So as you watched the trial go on and you perhaps, you know, listened to some of what the jurors said, a couple of them spoke and the foreperson spoke, what kind of bullet points did you take away from this case as a jury consultant?
It was very interesting. I mean, you do not normally get the kind of comments you got from the jurors here about the case. Generally, at the end of a case like this, they want to be very sure of their verdict, which we heard was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of comments that they felt the government may have overcharged and that they felt some of the charges were unwarranted. And that's the kind of talk you normally hear after an acquittal. But to hear it after conviction on 10 counts and then hanging on the other counts with most of the jurors in favor of acquittal, just a really interesting outcome and very, very unusual.
So a lot to talk about here. Do you sense that there was a compromise verdict? And maybe you can define that. You know, is there a negotiation going on? Do you think in the jury room where someone said, well, I'll give you a yes on this one if you give me a yes on this one? Do you think that does it sound like there was that kind of compromise going on?
That is something that can occur, but it did not sound like that was what happened in this particular case. It sounded much more likely that the jurors spent over 50 hours deliberating, and that's an incredibly long time, even though there were so many charges. And it seems much more that there were some counts that there was just general agreement on, and then it seemed like almost all the jurors were in favor of acquittal on the remaining counts, and except there were one or two holdouts. And so I don't think there was ever any, like sometimes called horse trading,
right,
to get some things done. But in this case, it looks like there was just happened to be an agreement on some and an almost consensus on the rest. And most of the time spent in deliberations was trying to get to a consensus on the charges that ended up being hung.
So there's a lot to talk about. You help select jurors when lawyers are going to trial. That's both civil and criminal cases. You kind of help craft theories of the case that appeal to jurors who are hearing the case. You have different aspects of what you do as a jury consultant. How important do you think jury instructions are in a case like this? Because my understanding is that the jury instructions were over 100 pages. There were all these different counts. There were two different defendants. There were all different theories of all different things spanning a decade of activities. How complicated are those instructions to a jury who has to read them for the first time and apply the law and facts?
They're incredibly complicated, which is why in most cases jurors end up basically ignoring them or misinterpreting them. And they generally come to a consensus about who they think should win, and then work backwards with the jury instructions. That doesn't appear to be the case. What happened here? This appears to be, from what the foreman said, they went through the jury instructions line by line and said if they didn't prove every line of this, then it has to be an acquittal. And that's exactly what the defense was telling them to do. But normally, the jurors get overwhelmed by the amount of evidence the prosecution can put forward, and they forget that stuff. And they just make a general consensus, well, we think that they're guilty and because of all the evidence we saw. Here they did what the defense wanted to do and actually made use of some very complicated instructions and just determined that the government hadn't met their burden of proof on many of the charges. It's really how a jury is supposed to deliberate. I know the defense can't be happy about a conviction on 10 counts, but this is as close as you can get to an acquittal without getting one.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about, and this is not something that you deal with, Dave, as a jury consultant, but the sentencing, you know, may not make a big difference that there were some acquittals and some hung counts because, you know, the way the sentencing works. And I want to talk to you about that when we return. If you have any questions for Dave Zahner, who is a trial consultant, give us a call here, 312-981-7200 on WGN. We're here with David Zahner. He is the founder of Zahner Trial Consulting, based in Chicago, helping lawyers in jury selections, mock trials, and witness preparations all over the country. Dave, thanks for holding with us. Some of the other comments from the jury foreperson was, you know, any time you send down 10 guilty verdicts against an individual, nobody should sleep well. Is that unusual? Did you sense that was an unusual comment?
Yes, again, that is something that is not usually expressed, especially after a guilty plea. Normally, the jurors are pretty convinced they got it right and don't have concerns about sleeping well and getting it wrong. I sensed the foreman really felt that he was close to pushing hard for an acquittal on all the counts, but then some of the evidence just made that impossible. And he just wasn't consistently concerned about what it was the government was doing and the way they made their charges, and it didn't sit well with him.
I totally agree with the read on what he said. I think that if he were the soldier, that he would have acquitted on all counts, and he thought the jury was that the government was overreaching. So if let's just say that you have a prosecutor who is going to overcharge. So let's just say maybe there are crimes that the government thinks are committed, but they want to overcharge just because they know that jurors will then look at all these different counts. They'll throw out some, they'll keep others, find guilty. And the bottom line is, from a sentencing standpoint, a guilty verdict on any one of these counts probably will put Michael Madigan in prison for as long as if he had all of them. You know, I'm just kind of summarizing. I'm not giving you my exact legal opinion on that. So, I mean, the jurors probably didn't understand that the fact that there was even one guilty verdict is probably going to put him away, you know, for a significant amount of time, given his age.
Right. And one of the things the judge always tells the jurors is that sentencing is my role, not yours, and you should not be concerned about what the impact of your decisions are. And that's the right thing for jurors to know. But it does surprise them when they're done. I'm sure that the foreman right now is very surprised to find out that it didn't really matter that they acquitted on so many charges and that there were hung charges, that the sentencing is going to be basically the same, as you said.
Yeah, you know, you're right, because the judge's job is to sentence, except, interestingly, in death penalty cases. We don't have the death penalty here in Illinois, but, you know, in death penalty cases, the jury gets to decide whether someone lives or dies, which I find to be kind of an amazing thing, because that's the ultimate sentence, in my opinion. But so in this case, let's just say the government has a tendency to overcharge with the idea that the jury is going to give you some and not give you others. Does that make jurors, in your view, look askance at some of the, you know, hey, if this is like, hey, the prosecutor had no right to bring this charge, it wasn't even close. Does that make them look at the other counts with kind of skepticism? Do you think it could backfire?
Yeah, and working from the defense side, which I often do, that is one of the things we try and get jurors to understand. It's like, hey, you start with the weakest charges the government made and say, if they're wrong here, maybe their entire theory of what happened is wrong. And you try and work backwards and get the jurors to say, we agree with you that they shouldn't have made these charges. Maybe that makes the rest of the charges weaker. However, it's incredibly difficult to do because the prosecution is able to put on such volumes of evidence and have the resources to show that almost all their charges have some justification. So, like in this case, when they found acquittals on some, it was based on a pretty technical reading of the law and going over the jury instructions. I didn't get the feeling that even the foreman thought that the charges were without merit. He just didn't think that they had proven their case, and that doesn't get you as far as you need from the defense side.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that Michael Madigan testified on the stand. And, you know, can you just walk us through how you, as a jury consultant, face that issue when it comes to a criminal trial? When you're talking to the lawyers who you are have been hired by, you're talking to your client about whether he or she should testify, what are your thoughts about it? Generally.
There's an incredibly strong resistance for lawyers to put their clients on the stand because they feel that 99% of what can happen are things that can go wrong. As part of our job as a jury consultant, though, is to try and show them that this may be the one in 100 case where your client does have to take the stand. And I think they made the right choice here to have him take the stand because of the fact there are tapes. Pretty much every time that I've been involved in a case where there are tapes of the defendant, they're basically testifying anyway. So you have a choice of letting what is said on the tapes, which is almost always highly prejudicial, stand as the only testimony for your client, or you have to take a shot at testifying also. Problem with a defendant like Michael Madigan is he is so used to being in control of every conversation he's a part of, it's very hard for him to accept his role as a witness is to just answer the questions. And as you heard from the jurors, they didn't like the fact that he would kind of ramble on and talk about what he wanted to do and not answer the question.
I did find that interesting. And, you know, one of the things that I was not in the courtroom, so it's always more difficult to talk about what's effective and what's not when you're not sitting in that courtroom watching how the jurors are reacting. But it seemed that there was a lot of background with him about his father, and his father's like maybe abusive, and about drinking, and about his, you know, his history of working on a garbage truck. And I mean, all of that to me was meant to make him a human being, so that if the jurors are going to go back there and convict him, this is a human being, not just somebody sitting there with a nice tie on. But you know, what do you think about that? Do you think that sort of backfired, that he was talking about things that were not relevant to the case?
Yeah, I think at least with some of the jurors, it backfired. The thought being, if you're not willing to answer the question and you're going into all these background areas, that means that the actual question is problematic for you and you don't want to give the answer. What we really work on when we prepare criminal defendants to testify is give the answer to the question as quickly and succinctly as possible and then move on. Every once in a while, you try and give them thematic things to work into their testimony, but those are usually things worked with the evidence and not background. My guess is, though, it's very difficult to convince someone who has been so skilled in dealing with people for 50 years that he doesn't know best about how to present his ideas. And my guess is some of his testimony was pretty much a compromise between what he was willing to go along with his lawyers and what his lawyers were suggesting that he do.
Yeah, and you know, when you have a very intelligent client who is an attorney, and like you said, is a person who's spoken for a living and made decisions easily for decades, it's hard to convince them what to do. And that's why you need a lawyer to be able to, you know, not force the client, but basically make sure the client understands that maybe he's not seeing it exactly the way others might be seeing it. It's a hard task when you have someone that intelligent and that strong-willed.
Yeah, the way we do it in our practice is we will do a mock run in front of potential people who are like the people who are going to be on the jury, and when they see the jurors potential jurors react to their testimony very negatively, that can sometimes scare them into listening to their lawyers. But it's very possible they weren't able to do that here. I don't know if they did any mock trial work. I wasn't aware of it, but I'd be really surprised if they didn't. And maybe they did test him out and this is the best they could get to.
Are there any broad takeaways from this case that you can make as far as generalizations? Or, I mean, obviously these are case-by-case situations, and jurors are, you know, different juries, and not only are jurors different, but the foreperson does a lot of the leading of how the jury conducts its work. So are there any broad takeaways? I mean, I've heard the newspaper say, oh, political corruption in Illinois is going to be harder to prove and harder to charge these days now after this mixed verdict. Is that something that you can conclude?
No, I think that would be a mistake to conclude that. I think that this case was just a very complicated case, and the defense did a very good job of showing some difficulties in the evidence. And while the prosecution was able to get a partial, I mean, it's a successful case for the prosecution when you get 10 counts guilty, and it will definitely send a message that prosecution is going to continue to go through with these kind of cases. I think it would be a mistake to say it'll be more difficult to convict people in political corruption cases in Illinois as a result from this. I think this was more based on kind of the facts of the case and basically his role and what people know about the way Illinois has worked for a long time.
And when you question, and we just have a couple of minutes here, can you hang for another segment, Dave? Can you?
Sure.
Okay, because we've got some texts and some calls, and I want to, if you have a call, a question for Dave, he's a jury consultant here in Chicago, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. When you question jurors to get a pool like this, and you're a prosecutor, who are you looking? Are you looking for those people who are sick and tired of corruption? Are you looking for those people who think everyone's corrupt, who holds an office? Because I hear those kinds of comments on the street all the time, that everybody who's in office is a bad guy, no matter which side of the aisle.
Yeah, what you're mainly looking for on the prosecution side is you're trying to get rid of people who are going to give the defendant the benefit of the doubt. You're basically people who could see themselves in the same position as the defendant, who could see themselves as, well, in my job or what I do, sometimes I skirt a little bit close to the edge on ethics. All those are the kind of people that they would definitely want to get rid of. And you basically want people who are going to listen to what the government has to say and then make the defense disprove it. So people who have trust in the government. And that is one thing that's eroding quite a bit in society now. So this kind of general rule that people in general think the prosecution must be doing the right thing, there's a lot of people who might not be thinking that way anymore. And that could be a major change in the way in the general types of jurors, and most jurors may not end up being as good for the government as they used to be.
And I want to talk about that because there is a recent poll that came out about how people view the justice system that's really astounding. And I want to talk about how that will affect all trials moving forward. We're here talking to Dave Zahner. He is a founder of Zahner Trial Consulting based in Chicago. How can people, what's your email address, Dave?
Dave@ZahnerJuries.com, ZahnerJuries.com.
We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. I'm here with Dave Zahner. He's the founder of Zahner Trial Consulting. We're talking about jury selection and jury dynamics and all of those things. Just recently, there was a Gallup poll that came out that reported that people disapproved of our justice system more than they ever have in the history of our country, or at least in the history of when they were doing polls. And we're down to 35%. Only 35% of Americans approve of our justice system. Dave, do you have any thoughts about why that might be? And if so, do you see that in the work that you're doing with selecting jurors?
What we've been seeing in our work so far has been an increasing polarization. It used to be on juries, you would have people try and work very hard to get along with each other and reach a consensus, because that's kind of what you have to do to get a result. What we're starting to see a lot more is people are unwilling to listen to the views of others. And I think that's one of the things that's driving this belief that the justice system is not working right, because people see outcomes that they don't accept, and therefore they feel that means the system is broken. It's a very problematic area, because if we lose a consensus about what the rule of law is, it makes the entire jury system fall apart.
You know, some of the reasons that were cited, and I don't know if this is speculation or based upon actual part of the poll, but, you know, you see certain Supreme Court decisions are overturned after 50 years, and people say, well, I thought that was the law, now it's not. Are we having a Supreme Court that's political in nature? Then we see all of these pardons that go on. I'm talking about both sides of the aisle, not just one side. And, you know, people feel very strongly about pardons, and even though they're legal, and obviously the president can do that, a lot of people disapprove of it and think they're being used for the wrong reasons. And there's other reasons, I suppose. But, you know, when a jury comes in and they have disbelief in the system, how does that affect how they decide a case? You know, let's just say a criminal case. Is it that they're going to look kind of askance at the prosecutors? Or are they going to just think that their verdict doesn't mean anything because there might be a pardon? I mean, what are they thinking about when they are in this state of, I don't like our system?
Yeah, there's two areas. One is, it used to be almost all jurors would believe that the only reason a prosecution would be brought is because the government thought it had evidence of a crime. And that is one thing that's been eroded over time. And jurors are thinking there might be other reasons now why prosecutions are being brought. And therefore, it's going to be a lot harder in some types of cases for jurors to, for the government to convince jurors. And, I mean, not so much in terms of evidence, but the fact that most jurors, when they are a juror in a criminal case, generally tend to believe what the prosecution is telling them, especially since the prosecution gets to go first. And now there might be a little more residual doubt there that defendants might be able to tap into.
Interesting. I had a texter. This is completely off topic, but maybe you know the answer to this. If you are serving on a jury and you want to be the foreperson, what is it that you should do to get that job?
Probably what you don't want to do is say, as the clip you showed, you don't want to say, "I want to do it."
Oh, really? Oh, you really?
Yeah, generally, when someone really wants to be the foreperson, the other people kind of are a little resistant because they don't like it when someone tries to take control of the process. So you should wait and see if anyone else wants to do it, and then say, well, if nobody else wants to do it, I'm happy to do it. That's probably the best way to get to become foreperson if you want. Don't immediately jump on it, but let everyone else kind of be quiet and then say, oh, I mean, if no one else wants to do it, I'll give it a shot. That makes it look like you're not trying to take control. You're just willing to help out the group because nobody else wants to do it.
Ah, that's some good advice. So, and again, you know, we're not watching the jurors in a little peephole or anything, but, you know, jurors can't talk about the case until they start deliberating. I mean, but they socialize and they have lunch together and they probably talk about their work and their children and other things. You know, what makes the jurors vote for a particular foreperson? What do you think? I mean, obviously it's case by case, but does someone kind of stand out as a leader? Is that what happens? Or what do you think?
What generally happens is that jurors get to know people, especially in a long trial like this one. And as you mentioned, they know what they do, what everyone does for a living, what they do with their families. And the kind of people that most jurors think are good forepersons are people like teachers, or people who have some kind of specialized knowledge or skills in group dynamics. So a lot of times when we do our focus groups, when the jurors select a surrogate juror, select a moderator, they'll select a teacher, or they'll select someone who does a lot of interaction with groups. And so they say, well, you're probably good at this. Why don't you be the foreperson?
Ah, very, very interesting. And here's a kind of a random question that someone asked me a while ago. How important is not just the lawyer's, I'm not talking about the lawyer's skill, the lawyer's preparation, the lawyer's experience, but really just the lawyer's style. So much is said about how a lawyer dresses, you know, how dynamic they are. Are they flamboyant? Are they low key? Like, how much of that actually weighs into a jury's verdict? Generally, I know these are all general questions.
Lawyers hate when I answer this question, but generally none of it. The style, and I mean, you can lose a case by being obviously unprepared or wasting the juror's time. But if you're a generally competent attorney, it doesn't matter if you're low key, flashy, whatever it is. What the jurors are really interested in is what you have to say, not how you say it. And I have seen the best, most dynamic lawyers lose cases because they start to believe that they can just kind of get away with not really having the evidence or having the themes. And instead, what really happens is jurors really do look at the actual facts of the case, and they get, if they feel that the lawyer is trying to overcome them with flash, they do notice that, and they don't like people trying to make them to fool them.
And I totally agree with you, although I will tell you a quick war story. I tried a long case years ago, and the lawyer against me, I will tell you, was not a nice guy in trial. I mean, out of court, he was perfectly fine, but he was mean. And he would disparage the witnesses. He would disparage them because maybe they weren't as literate as he was, or they weren't as educated as he was. He was mean-spirited to me. He made comments about me. He wasn't very nice to the judge. And after the trial, I was successful in this trial, and the people came up to me and said, "We hated his guts. We almost wanted to vote for your clients just because we hated him." And I never heard that before, but you know, I think that was like one of those over the top situations. But
That's an example of the lawyer being able to lose the case.
Yes,
you can lose a case by how you interact with jurors. And we do always tell lawyers, jurors notice everything. They notice how you treat. If you have an assistant at the table, they notice how you treat them. They notice how you treat other people. And especially if this was a male lawyer, I'm sure the female jurors notice how he was treating you.
Yeah, they were the most vociferous, let's just say.
We do see that a lot.
Yeah. They pick that up for sure. And it's the little things. It's really a lot of the little things. They're more observant than you think. Just one last question off topic. We have the Highland Park shooting case that's going to trial tomorrow morning, and we're in the jury selection phase. And I'm going to talk a little bit about it from a legal standpoint. But from your standpoint, I mean, you know, we have a defendant. There are a bunch of people who died and 48 people injured. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence against the defendant. This was a crime that was committed in an idyllic, you know, setting in a beautiful suburb on the 4th of July. And, you know, it's going to be difficult to find a defense jury, I would think, that would really be prone to really considering the evidence carefully. Am I wrong about that, or do you think that it's possible to find a fair jury?
I think it's possible to find a fair jury, but I think it's impossible to find a jury that doesn't already have some pre-existing biases and beliefs. And so what the defense will be trying to do is pick out people who have already made up their minds. And the people who say, no matter what evidence you show me, I'm going to send him to prison. Because I'm sure they'll be making some type of mental competency defense, even if it's not explicit. And they want jurors who will at least consider that. People who maybe in their lives have dealt with issues involving mental health, who might have some understanding for what happened here, some sympathy for a young man who's obviously has had some serious issues in his life that led to this. And I don't think this is a case where they'd be looking for an acquittal, but what they'll be looking for is some type of leniency based on mental competency. And that is possible to get a jury that can understand that. I do think in this case it's going to be extremely difficult, given, the emotions that this whole situation brought up.
Absolutely. Dave Zahner, thank you so much for joining us on this Sunday afternoon. Zahner Trial Consulting, can you tell our listeners where they can contact you?
Sure. You can. Our website is zahnerjuries.com, ZehnerJuries.com.
Thank you so much. Take care.